ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Okay, now we've never done this before on Future Tense, which is probably a very good reason for doing it. And for those of you who I know will predictably object, let me just say this. Yes, I know I work for a public broadcaster. Yes, I know we're not supposed to do blatant product endorsements, commercials, ads, whatever you want to call them. Yes, yes, yes. But we're going to do it anyway. So here goes. This week's Future Tense is proudly brought to you by the following sponsor.
Hello, my name is Alan Levinovitz. I'm the creator of the Unpacked Diet, which allows you to eat whatever foods you want because it is based on the scientific truth that it is food packaging, the plastics, the microplastics, the aluminum foil that we use in our daily lives that are making us sick. And as long as you eat foods that haven't been contaminated by that packaging, you are free to eat whatever you want in the way that nature intended it to be packaged and served.
Yes, it's the Unpacked Diet, developed and spruced by Alan. It's simple, it's cost-effective, and if you're not already convinced, there are people out there who'll happily tell you that it changed their lives. Which is interesting, really, because while the Unpacked Diet does actually exist, it was cooked up by Professor Levinovitz as a piece of satire. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. On the show today, better understanding our relationship with food and with the whole notion of natural. Why, when we're choosing what to eat, does it increasingly seem important to always embrace the natural option?
When it comes to something like what we eat, it's always going to be bound up with morality. So if you think about sustainability or animal ethics when it comes to the meat we eat, and you might not think that eating naturally is about eating morally, but in fact, nature is more like a stand-in for God. It's a secular stand-in for God. And so when people eat naturally, they think they are eating not just what is in nature, but rather what nature means for us to eat, what we ought to eat, the way we should be eating, as opposed to artificial, modern, fallen foods that we should not be eating.
Hence the idea behind Alan's satirical Unpacked Diet, a diet that gets rid of the artifice associated with modern food, removing the wrapper, as it were, and stripping it back to its quote-unquote natural state. Because the term natural, says Professor Levinovitz, in our minds, connotes goodness and a sense of virtue.
So the best way to think about it, I think, is with the myth of paradise past. So imagine a time in the past when everything was natural. That is to say, it was all uninterfered with by human beings. And then the so-called Garden of Eden story says that we did something wrong and we fell out of the garden. One of the punishments, interestingly, in the Hebrew Bible, the Christian Bible in Genesis, is that you have to practice agriculture. So there's this idea that there's an ideal state of being, that is the natural state. And then we've fallen away from that. And if we want to fix our problems, if we want to fix our pain, if we want to fix our illness, then we need to return to that ideal natural state. And of course, that is going to depend. What that natural state looks like depends on whatever it is that people are inclined to want to eat or want to believe in. But the logic of it always remains the same. So everyone is probably familiar with ideas of kosher or halal food, where foods have to be approved by a deity or prepared in a particular way in accordance with the norms of a religion. And I think that as the scope of religion's authority has shrunk, so we no longer go to our priest for dietary recommendations or medical prescriptions, we are looking for a similar kind of authority, an authority that can tell us this is the right way to eat and the right way to live. And we're substituting a secular version of God, and that is nature and naturalness. And people have been doing this for a very long time, and they use it to justify whatever it is that they eat.
So is our obsession, if you like, with natural food, with naturalness, is that in some ways a salve to our fears about the world and the way we as human beings are seen to be messing it up?
Absolutely. Although I should point out that wanting things to be natural is a cross-cultural and trans-historical phenomenon. So in ancient China, which is my area of expertise, you find people extolling the virtues of a state called Zuran, which literally means self-so or organic of itself. So another way to think about natural is it's unmanipulated. It's organic. It's grassroots. And I believe humans don't want to feel manipulated, and they think that manipulation is bad, and they think that things that are spontaneous and organic are better, which is why people use the contradictory phrase, act naturally. And food is no different. And I think you're absolutely right as well that in modern times, there's even more of a need to connect with naturalness because we're surrounded by increasingly technological products that we don't understand.
Now, some unnatural foods have improved health outcomes, and I'm thinking particularly, say, of pasteurized milk. How do we square that with this notion of unnatural is bad, is evil, and natural is good?
Well, the first thing to say is that the foods that people consider natural today are manifestly unnatural. So strawberries used to be the size of our pinky nails, and chickens did not have gigantic breasts, and cows did not wander the savannas in ancient times. Everything we eat today from the most organic farm you can imagine is highly unnatural. We've manipulated it. So it's the contradictions are there. I think that what's really important is to understand why it is that people want natural things and natural foods. And I became sympathetic to that desire. When I started writing my book, Natural, I thought it was going to be a kind of debunking, showing how it's silly, you know, the whole, oh, well, cyanide is natural and it kills you kind of thing. And by the end, I actually really understood that when people said natural, they meant something else that really was important and that we need to have when it comes to what we eat.
That said, Professor Levinowitz also maintains that the use of the term natural and the focus on natural helps to give a false sense of scientific objectivity to our selection of food and to what we eat.
What I would like to see is some reflection on what people mean when they say natural and then substitute other things. So for example, unmanipulated can mean transparent. And I think it's really important that food production companies are transparent about how they make their foods, about where the foods come from. I'd like to see supply chains be transparent. That's a really important thing, and consumers are right to demand that. However, confusing transparency with naturalness is bad because, as you said, it can make it seem as if the good that people want can be found in seeking what is natural, and that's actually not true. And so naturalness provides a very simple, intuitive heuristic for choosing what it is that goes into your body. It's just, unfortunately, it's not a very good heuristic.
So we should then focus more on what is going to be better for us, for our bodies, and also better for the environment, rather than this notion of natural.
That's exactly right. And also, sometimes people like natural things. So I'm sitting in my office right now, and I have many plants. I like plants. And if these plants were unnatural, artificial, plastic plants, I would like them less, just because I like the idea of natural plants. However, I can't also then believe that having these plants is going to make me live longer or is going to make me healthier or anything like that. I simply like them because they're natural. So the same thing goes for, you know, if you're like me, like going to the farmer's market and you can talk to the people that have produced your food. That's nice. It's a nice idea. And that's fine to value that sort of connection with your food. You can't just also assume that that food is going to be better for you or better for the environment. And that is what terms like natural, God terms, nature do, is they promise you that whatever has the label is good in every single way. After all, if God designed something, it wouldn't be bad for your health, but good for the environment. It would be good for in all ways. And that's the idea that people seem to import with natural foods. It's foods that are good in every single way.
And there is a sense of privilege involved in that idea of natural, isn't there? Which can easily be manipulated.
Without a doubt. If you go back a little ways, white bread was actually the preferred food of elites. And as white bread became the cheaper, easier bread to produce, this shifted. And then whole grain breads were the preferred food of elites. And of course, people make all sorts of health claims. I'm not saying that you should only eat white bread all day long. But I think, as you said, it's important to be careful and watch how what is conceived of as natural can also map the contours of economic privilege in any given society.
Author and religious scholar Alan Levinowitz from James Madison University in the US. And here's another caution. It's important to be aware that the modern alternatives to what we now deem unhealthy foods aren't always necessarily good for you. What do I mean by that? Well, let me give you just one example. In our black and white, right and wrong world, meat, particularly red meat, is bad, while plant-based meat alternatives are good. Because grazing cows is bad for the environment, and we all know too much red meat is associated with a higher risk of cancer.
We've seen in Australia that a lot of people aren't necessarily saying they're vegetarian or vegan, but they're reducing the amount of meat in their diet. So I think it's estimated about 40% of people in Australia consider themselves as a meat reducer, or a flexitarian might be a term they're using. So these people are then replacing their meats with more plant-based alternatives.
Laura Marchese from the Institute for Physical Activity and Nutrition at Deakin University.
I think we can all remember a time when you went to the supermarket and if you're going to buy a vegetarian option, you might have an option of tofu, you might have a tempeh, but otherwise you would be picking from the canned beans or the dried beans section. But nowadays, if you wanted to buy an alternative for meat, you've got a wide range of options, both, you know, those traditional sources of plant-based foods such as beans and tofu, but we also have more novel options now for replacing meat, as well as alternatives to dairy made from a wide range of ingredients, such as nuts or oats or rice and so on.
Okay, that's the way the world is turning. But just how healthy are those novel, increasingly popular healthy alternatives? Well, that's what Laura Marchese and her colleagues also asked themselves. So they set about the task of conducting what they call a nutritional audit.
So what we wanted to do was get a snapshot of the food environment that we have for plant-based meat and dairy alternatives in Australia. So we went to 8 supermarkets in Melbourne, so 2 each of our 4 leading retailers, and collected all of the plant-based meat and dairy alternatives that they had. We collated all of the nutrition information panels data, and because we collected over 700 products, you can assume that we did find a wide variety of results.
And the most worrying result involved the composition of plant-based meats.
We know that Australians are having too much salt in their diets, and it's really not good for our blood pressure or heart health. So from our audit, we found that the amount of salt in plant-based meats did vary a lot. We found that the lowest amount was in tofu, which ranged, you know, from 1 milligram all the way up to plant-based mints, which had up to 2,000 milligrams. And 2,000 milligrams is the maximum amount of sodium that we're meant to have per day.
And you found, didn't you, that the salt content has been going up in plant-based meats over the last couple of years.
Yeah, so we compared our results to previous audits conducted in Australian supermarkets. And previous audits found that in 2014, there was up to 640 milligrams of sodium per 100 grams in these meat alternatives, whereas our data found up to 2,000 milligrams. So that's about 3 times as much sodium in about 10 years. So there's a trend clearly that they're getting saltier, which isn't good for our health.
Was salt also a factor with plant-based milks and plant-based dairy products?
Not as much so. So for the plant-based dairy, we focused on calcium because we know calcium is really important for our bone health and is traditionally a good source in the dairy alternatives. So when we looked at calcium, we first of all focused on plant-based milks and have some good news here that we found 70% of the plant-based milks on our supermarket shelves do have added calcium. So that's really fantastic. And the majority of these, about 73% of them, have the recommended amount of calcium in them. But when we started to look at the yogurts and the cheeses, we did see less calcium in them. So calcium was only labelled on a third of the plant-based yogurts, unfortunately, and barely any of the plant-based cheeses had added calcium. So that's really disappointing.
And what about saturated fat levels?
Of course, anytime we're purchasing anything processed or anything from a supermarket, we do really want to pick something that's low in saturated fat for our health. So when we looked at the plant-based cheeses, we did find an alarming range of the saturated fat content, ranging from 0 grams all the way up to 28 grams per 100 grams, which is extremely high. And when we looked at the plant-based milks and the plant-based yogurts, we found that the coconut options more specifically were higher in saturated fat than those made from other ingredients, such as soy or oat or rice, for example. So if you are going to buy a plant-based yogurt or plant-based milk, if you're going to choose a coconut option, double-check the saturated fat or pick an alternative made from a different main ingredient.
How difficult is it for people to interpret what is in the product that they're buying? How clear are the ingredient listings?
It can be really tricky when you're at the supermarket to understand and pick the healthiest option, especially, you know, in a limited time frame. You might not want to spend that much time at the supermarket. So if you flip over the back of the pack, all products have to have an ingredients list. So try pick foods where you recognize all of the items on the ingredients list. You know, if you were to give that item to a grandma or a neighbor, if they don't recognize one of the ingredients on there, maybe, you know, you should look for an alternative. We do see a lot of food additives, and that means that we've got more of these ultra-processed foods available in the supermarkets at the moment. We do really want to avoid them as much as possible because, unfortunately, we know in Australia we're just consuming way too much of these ultra-processed foods, which are full of ingredients that you just would never recognize. So we've seen overseas that there's some countries which they label a food if it's ultra-processed, and it would be wonderful to see that here one day. We also see overseas that some countries have further labeling for the sustainability of the item. And so in Australia, it would be wonderful if one day we had a label which combined the healthiness of the item as well how sustainable it is, mandatory across all of our products, just to make it as simple as possible for the everyday Australian to go to the supermarket and pick a great option just for the planet as well as their own health.
And that idea of a climate sustainable food label isn't just a wishful thought. Sarah Bridle is the Chair in Food, Climate and Society at the University of York.
At the moment, I think a lot of people don't really know the climate impact of their food. It's really, really hard to find that information out as a consumer going into a shop and looking at the products. So, you know, it'd be really fantastic if we had that information available to people who want to include that information in their decision making. There's a few products now which have climate impact. So grams of CO2e, this would be GCO2e on a packet if you were looking for that sort of thing. But there's very, very few products that have that information at the moment. We do need to agree the methodology, you know, the way that we calculate those numbers need to be the same for all the products on the shelves. And so at the moment, there's work going on to agree the exact method that everybody needs to use. But once that's done, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't have that across all the packets and then be able to factor that into our decision making.
And has any jurisdiction to date, has it gone down that path, down the food climate labelling path?
So Denmark has said it will bring it in. In the UK, where I am, I'm on a government advisory committee, which is working out the methodology for any products that do have that information to use the right methodology. But that's obviously a necessary first step before you could then bring in a mandatory emissions reporting.
A work in progress, as they say. But getting back to the here and now, and basic ingredient labelling aside, what other options are available to those seeking to be better informed about the kinds of things that are increasingly being pumped into our food? Well, one option is to use a food rating app, like the one developed by Julie Chapon and her company Yuka. Yuka uses a colour-coded system to let shoppers make quick in-store decisions.
It's very simple. If the product is red, it means that it's bad for your health for different reasons that we explain in the app. And if it's green, it means that it's okay for your health. And the scoring method takes into account three criteria. So the first criteria, which is the main one, is the nutritional quality, which represents 60% of the score, based on a science-based nutrition label adopted by several European countries. So this is for the first criteria. The second one is the presence of additives, which represent 30% of the score. And our analysis of food additives is done by our toxicologists and based on the most up-to-date scientific research. And well, the remaining 10% is dedicated to the organic component of the product, so products that have an official organic label. So basically, if a product is red, it means that it has both a bad nutritional quality and some controversial additives.
So the app gives you a colour-coded score, but it also provides information, doesn't it, that explains why the app has made that decision on that particular product?
Yes. So the information about the rating is available in the app so that the users can understand why your product has a good or a bad rating. So if a product has a bad rating, you can access all the details in the app. You can see that it may have, I don't know, way too much salt and controversial additives. And if it has controversial additives, you can see which ones and what are the risks linked to these particular additives so that you can understand the rating.
The barcode reading Yuka app now has more than 6 million active users across 12 countries, and it can interpret the ingredients of more than 3 million products, according to Julie Chapon. So what's it like to use?
Hi, my name's Lisa. I started using the app because I'm interested in eating a bit more healthily, and I was learning about UPFs, ultra-processed foods, and trying to find out which products had UPFs in them and really struggled, and I used it for that reason. So the app's really straightforward. You just open it up so you can scan pretty much everything in the supermarket. I've very rarely found anything I couldn't scan.
Lisa is based in Brisbane, and using her food rating app is now a regular part of her grocery shopping experience.
So I guess there were some things that I was expecting to be pretty unhealthy, the sweets and the biscuits and all the junk. But the things that really surprised me were stuff like soy milk that you would really think would be healthy, and actually certain brands, absolutely fine, but some brands are full of weird and wonderful stuff, and some of them have quite nasty chemicals and additives in them. So the one I'm looking at now has 8 risky additives. Some are hazardous, some just moderate risk. So the hazardous one is diphosphates, which increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, disrupt calcium metabolism and bone mineralization, and negatively affect the kidneys, according to the app. But it's really strange. Like, some things, if you look at pickled gherkins, they're all pretty good. If you look at pickled jalapenos, they're full of weird and wonderful stuff, dangerous additives. So it really comes and goes depending what you scan. I'm all for vegetarian alternative products. There are loads of really healthy ones out there. But if you look at margarines, which were always billed as the healthy alternative, most margarines are full of all kinds of additives and saturates. Whereas if you look at butter, obviously they're full of fat, but they don't have those additives in them, or not all of them anyway. So I've just scanned one margarine. It tells me there are 4 additives I should avoid and that it's much too caloric. In this case, the additive that should be avoided is potassium sorbate. Actually, this one is butter, so it's not so straightforward as butter versus margarine. I'm looking at one butter that has 2 additives that are a moderate risk and 2 additives that the app says is no risk.
So if, like our Brisbane shopper Lisa, you're keen to keep watch on what you eat, a food ingredient app could be the answer. But according to Yuka's Julie Chapon, what's important from her perspective is to influence not just the consumers of processed food, but the producers as well.
For the moment, our big challenge is the US. So in Europe, the app is massively used and has had a huge impact on manufacturers. For instance, in Europe, many manufacturers have started reformulating their products and improving their quality. Now we want to replicate that in other countries like the US, like Australia. And that's our big challenge, because these are countries that also need manufacturers to improve their products. So what is important to mention is that it's really important for us to stay 100% independent so that no one can influence our ratings. And for full transparency, our balance sheet is public on our website. So this is really important for the trust. And, well, I think what is also important to mention is that we have a toxicologist who analyzes all the new studies that come out, and all our analysis on food additives are based on the most up-to-date scientific research.
Julie Chapon, and out of interest, her company is also looking at further developing the kind of sustainable eco-labelling we heard about earlier. At this point, they're concentrating specifically on the French consumer market. Finally today, as the world gets hotter and we look for measures to try and rein in greenhouse gas emissions, a reminder of the part our modern food system plays in the wider climate change equation. Sarah Bridle again, from the University of York.
So overall, food contributes about 1/3 of all climate change. And so that includes clearing land for agriculture, so deforestation. It includes raising animals, producing crops, but also processing, transportation, packaging, cooking and food waste. So all of those things together add up to cause about 1/3 of all climate change.
And of all those elements just listed, says Professor Bridle, the one that's often overlooked is the way we prepare our food, the means we use for cooking.
We looked at surveys of the ways that people did cooking. So we looked at the cooking methods that they used and also the amount of time that they used those methods for. And then we added that to the greenhouse gas emissions of actually producing the foods, and then looked at the relative contribution of cooking and producing foods to see the impact on climate change. So we have to include cooking because, for example, we might be burning fossil fuels in our ovens, or in order to produce electricity to cook our food using electricity in our homes. And this depends on the food, really. But for some foods, cooking would actually be the largest contribution to climate change, even bigger than producing the food itself. By far, the worst way to cook food in terms of climate change is in the oven. Because if you think about it, you've got to heat up this big metal box as well as the food itself. And usually if we're cooking in the oven, we might put the oven on for 15 minutes or so beforehand to warm up. And then we might have the oven on for maybe 1 or 2 hours to cook that food. So if we look at an example of a baked potato, then putting the oven on, if you're just cooking one potato for one person in the oven, then actually that oven cooking could be more than half of your daily kind of budget for the amount of greenhouse gas emissions you can sort of cause from food. So for the lowest impact foods, cooking is a large proportion of the climate impact. So potato is a really good example because it's very low greenhouse gas emissions to produce a potato, but it's the kind of food that we might put in the oven for a long time. And also if you're doing like roast vegetables in the oven, you've chopped them all up and you've got them in the oven for an hour or two, then those vegetables would again be very low greenhouse gas emissions to produce. But on the other hand, the cooking would then be the dominant cause of climate change. So there's lots of other cooking methods that are much better than the oven, but also you could consider cooking something like a potato in the microwave oven, for example, and then just crisping it up under the grill. So you could still get some of that crunchiness, but actually in just for a small amount of time, say 10 minutes under the grill, that'd be much, much better than say 2 hours in the oven.
In other words, and it pains me to say this, ditch the roast. The simple changes we can do to help ensure a better future and coming to terms with our not always helpful obsession with the idea of natural. Today on Future Tense, we heard from Sarah Bridle, Julie Chapon, our Brisbane-based shopper Lisa, Laura Marchese, and Alan Levinovitz. Next week on the show, a chat with Nobel Prize-winning economist Abhijit Banerjee from MIT. He's part of the world's largest ever UBI trial, UBI standing for Universal Basic Income. It's now 2 years into a 12-year run, and Dr. Banerjee will join us not just to talk about the economic results so far, but also the social impacts.
You see very, very large, strikingly large reductions in depression and improvements in people's self-reported well-being. These effects are very large, larger than we expected. In a time when we are really worried about mental health issues, in particular depression among the young, as a huge social issue, I feel that this fact that we're beginning to see large effects on mental health is another reason why doing some kind of program that's more generous, more stable, with a lot of predictability and a fair amount of generosity might actually help us with these issues that I think most societies are now struggling with.
That's an update on the world's largest universal basic income trial underway in Kenya. Next time on the show. Until then, my thanks as always to co-producer and co-creator Karin Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.